Spring in New Hampshire. 1. A whooshing passed over us and perched on a branch. Something seesawed in the bright dark air, sailed the clearing sharp-eyed through pole pine sapling, beech, maple, and hemlock, Blake says, are threatened beyond saving. Once we were too far north to worry about infestations, but now we must, I guess. Earth's breath is fast as hyperventilation, and no one, not even scientists, knows why or what will come. I tell him spirits we walk among steel glasses. Last week, mine whisked off and weirdly found after in New York, or frizzle our lines until they squiggle, and we wonder what we've made or if it can be fixed. 2. Yesterday, I watched an ant hauling a burden across the drive before me. It dropped the object to trek in ever-widening circles, coming back to resume the task once it had found the way all clear. The ant built small piles of spruce needles to camouflage its find, which, when I went to look, was a spider, too big for the anthill's opening. That had to be dug out. I showed Blake when he stopped, who carried with him two books on animal symbols, the ant being patience and the spider creativity, though maybe not a dead spider. Later I found beside the entrance the ant excavated for hours, a little mound of dirt and both ant and spider crushed by a car. Today, no trace that they had been. 3. Blake will not speak of ghosts. He'll talk of animals, trees, weather, and angels, but only briefly. Spirits are not the same as ghosts, and angels, of course, are very rare. Didn't I know that? He has to go. At night, down the alley of trees, the low-reaching, feather-like boughs suture the air as we draw the efflorescence from this wound on which the world stretched before us, teal and oily like a sea.
Welcome to Poets Cafe. We're here with our wonderful guest who's joined us, Cynthia Hoag, from Arizona. Cynthia's published 14 collections of poetry. Most recently, Revenants. She's co-authored When the Water Came, Evacuees of Hurricane Katrina. She's the winner of the 2013 Harold Morton Landon Translation Award from the Academy of American Poets. The honors go on and on. A fellowship at the Beinecke Library at Yale University and a residency at McDowell Colony. Your esteemed presence here is very appreciated. You're also teaching in the MFA program at Arizona State University. Yeah, welcome, Cynthia.
Thank you so much.
This is a beautiful collection. Just astonishing. It was very hard going over all of these poems to decide which one to bring to the surface today for our readers. But tell me about the origins of this book. You're reading from Revenants, and this is published by Red Hen Press. How did you condense this idea into a collection?
The collection took shape over the time in which was about 4 years, the time in which I was traveling a lot across country to help out with elder care.
Mm.
And I was also getting some residences, like McDowell, mm-hmm. and the Wurlitzer Foundation in Taos. And those are places that, in addition to artists congregating there and this critical mass of creativity coming out of the place, they also seem to be places, power places.
Mm-hmm. Interesting phrase, yeah.
Yeah, and places where there's high energy.
Mm-hmm.
Creative, and perhaps it felt a little visionary. And slowly over time, as I was traveling a lot and spending time beginning to write these poems and beginning to see where the next project was heading, people began to tell me stories of, I guess I would call them otherworldly encounters. Mm-hmm. And I was beginning, as my parents neared their ends, I was beginning to have some inexplicable experiences myself. It's very, very moving, of course, but also otherworldly time as you're accompanying someone into that passage.
Yes.
So I started to write things down, and then I began to create poems of some of these stories. And then I began to some of the stories that people were telling me about. Mm-hmm. And then I began to experience some things. Mm. And over these 4 years, the direction of the volume began to take shape. But there were forays into ekphrastic poems. Mm-hmm. And there were forays into the political context in which I was writing. For example, Spring in New Hampshire ends with that teal and oily like a sea. Mm-hmm. And I was writing it at the time of the BP oil spill.
Ah, right.
So that doesn't otherwise impact the poem, except there is that bit about Blake speaking of global warming.
Yes.
So,
and throughout this wonderful collection, there's this sense, I mean, the title, Revenants, is so beautiful. Thinking about the origins of that word, and there's kind of a macabre sensibility of it, you know, somebody coming back from the dead, but then there's a supernatural aspect of that return, and also a person or thing being reborn. So you're collection really has these wonderful forays into these experiences of your own and your interactions with others, and it's almost archaeological in a sense. Did you feel that? I mean, you seem like in reading your work, the kind of poet who isn't just coming along necessarily looking for inspiration, but you're actively exchanging.
I listen a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I trained in conflict resolution quite a while ago.
With the Mennonites, right?
With the Mennonites.
That's right. You've had some very interesting jobs.
Interesting foray, forays. And in conflict resolution, one of the key techniques is attentive listening.
Okay.
Because it's a skill when you think about it. Mm-hmm. Interviewers, of course, like
right.
you, have developed that skill. We don't think about what the effect of giving someone our full attention is until we practice it. And when you have somebody who's very intent on telling you something, sometimes if they're upset or sometimes if they're deeply moved, and you give them that full attention, it's as if you are meditating. You are bringing full attention. And you're giving them that gift of full attention, but they're giving you the gift of their story.
Yes.
Which is often housing something very precious or essential about them. So.
And you feel that.
You feel that.
Yeah, I mean, the recipient of the listener feels that attention. And we're all craving attention to some extent. And
absolutely.
I don't mean the kind of attention we get in social media,
yeah.
of course, but the intimate attention of one-on-one.
Yeah.
And somebody to really be present and listen, it really is a gift.
And I had the time I had a sabbatical, for example. Mm-hmm. So I had the time to listen to people in places where I was writing. People were having experiences, deep, deep, magical experiences that for whatever reason they were sharing, maybe because I was listening, they were sharing with me. And I would transform them. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, any kind of elder care or care of another entails listening.
Right.
And you have this sense that this is very transitory. So the listening is for good.
Yes.
The listening is...
And that is really the essence of this book, the transitory.
Yeah.
And how you have been able to write this down in a way that makes the reader feel that transitory aspect. It reminds me of a poem that by Rilke, What Survives, Who Knows What Remains. Who knows what survives? Perhaps the flight of the bird you wound remains. Something like this. I don't know all of it, but this essence, these fragments. And you had contact with a poet, a Samizdat poet, mm-hmm. and that's a perfect example of what we're talking about, really. Why don't you tell me a little bit of what happened there?
Olga Sedekova is a very well-known poet now in Russia, but she came to prominence as a Samizdat poet, a resistance poet, an underground poet during mm-hmm. the Soviet Union, when the poetry was distributed by word of mouth, by mimeographs, sometimes by hand. So she wrote to be able to survive censors.
Mm-hmm. She was a Christian, right?
She is a Christian. She's mm-hmm. a very, very devout Christian, which, of course...
Pre-Glasnost, that was not
absolutely.
Acceptable.
Mm-hmm. That was not allowed. And she was brought to Bucknell through the Russian program. I was teaching at Bucknell University and running the Poetry Center, the Stadler Center there at the time. So we helped to fund that residency. And my colleague, Slava Yastrzemski, and I interviewed her in the Poet's Cottage. And it was a beautiful, beautiful fall day. Early fall, mm-hmm. September 15th, something like that. Many years ago, we were still using tape recorders. And both of the good tape recorders broke. And I had thrown in a little cheap Radio Shack mm-hmm. tape recorder, which was not up to recording the interview, which entailed English with a heavy Russian accent.
Right.
So the quality of the tape was not high enough for us to transcribe it. Mm-hmm. And I tried for many years to transcribe it. Many years of long-suffering RAs, and I had a high-powered technician in New York, tried a doctor and save the tape. And it didn't work, so I ended up with 20 pages of scattered words. Scattered patches.
And this was something that transpired in a very deep way. There was, you know, because as we know, when we have these intense conversations, they're ephemeral, but you remember them. And then to try and recreate that somehow is challenging.
We had hoped to have it on tape so that although the actual conversation was ephemeral, it was recorded for history.
Yes.
So it became what we remembered. And when I picked it up, maybe 10, 15 years later, I was trying to distract myself from these sad trips back east for elder care.
Mm-hmm.
And I just began to work with what was left of the interview as if it were found material, because at that point it was.
Right.
It was, I had been invited to participate in an issue in our journal, Hayden's Ferry Review at Arizona State, that brought artifacts and poems that we had made out of the artifacts together.
So it was a perfect, situation in which to recreate that.
And literally to excavate.
Absolutely,
the archaeology of that day.
And you're going to be reading from that. And before you do, I want to tell you that our listeners, we're here at Poets Cafe with our wonderful guest, Cynthia Hoag, and she's sharing her work and her world with us. This is from her book, Revenants, with Red Hen Press.
So I'll read the first part.
Okay.
And then perhaps another part.
Sure.
I'll just say that the poem takes on the structure of question-answer.
Okay.
Okay, so you'll hear that. Everything could be written down because you would understand, although perhaps differently, how the meaning of words survives their context. Yes. They were so clear. Yes. Use capital T when referring to them. These nebulous and unconcretizable words register flickering realities out of love of freedom. They do this out of love, without which we are useless. The carnal aspect of incarnation is what is most resisted. Nothing which seems at once very abstract, as nothing is, and also very concrete, as in adding the definite article, the nothing that is. Where do these words come from? Is nothing existential, metaphysical, religious? Yes. So this knocking on the door at the end is, this is the rain. Is it not an allusion to history? Yes. No. The rain becomes a manifestation of this amazing power to rain, which comes at the end. The water is proof there is a God.
Beautiful. Thank you. Somehow, the essence of the words do remain, don't they? When you're even in these fragmented ways that are so lyrically brought together, I mean, you've still retained the essence of the conversation. And in some ways, it's like a different birth. It's not the original word-for-word text. It becomes its own entity. I think
it really does. You recompose it literally.
Mm-hmm.
So you're recontextualizing the original words, which are already fragmented, and you're creating something new that didn't exist before with these recontextualized and juxtaposed fragments.
Mm-hmm.
So a new unity actually comes into being. There are fragments to this poem, and each section hovers in the middle of the space of the page to honor its something like the ghost of its original context.
Right, that's
something
a good
like
way
that.
Of putting it. Yeah, the ghost.
But there's a synergy
mm-hmm.
that begins to happen, and the underlying unity, or the rediscovered, the discovered unity, emerges.
Right, and is there and sustains.
Yeah, yeah.
I really, it makes me want to take a workshop, because as a poet, you know, we're constantly, our thoughts can be fragmented. We have this beautiful idea here or some sustained memory, but it hasn't become anything yet. Mm-hmm. It's just there. And you want, yet you want to be able to articulate that in some way so that it has some integration into maybe like, as you have, you know, a larger body of work.
And you want it to resonate.
Yes.
So that we write without really knowing all the time where the work is going to go.
That's right.
The discovery is in, the exploration is in the writing. So
yes,
we know by going where we have to go.
Which reminds me of another poem from your other book, Incognito Body.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic exploration into, well, into the world of pain. Yeah. And how it manifests in us and what it takes away and what it gives. And there's a poem that you, in particular, that I loved called The Seeker. And I wonder if you'd share that. We could talk a little bit about it.
Okay. The Seeker, after Tarkovsky's Stalker. I live on the zone's edge, which we call the forest. Why, you ask? Why what, I ask back. For my calling, I crawl vermin-like through a glade with a battalion of burnt tanks, their guns every which way, matchsticks. A cast-iron stove simmers in a field of good intentions, boils over under a clear sky when we pass. Up ahead, hope remains in the one intact room left in a house overlooking the river valley. I am taking you to fear's threshold. Who? Anyone who asks. Rain curtains the room's entrance. Elsewhere, a phone rings. You pick up the receiver. No, this is not the maternity ward. Now it rains in the room itself. Water filling with fish that knows the oily rainbowed swirls come from nowhere. You've walked to the archway, paused to say, it's raining in the room. I say, I don't know the way out, only the way in. My daughter, when her big heart burst, stared so hard at the book, the glass, the hand-painted pitcher of water on the table. They shook as if the past hurtled nearby. They inched toward her, moving, but she was not moved. When the book fell open, she mouthed the words, not looking up, not looking really for anything at all.
If you're just tuning in, this is Lois P. Jones with my very special guest, Cynthia Hoag, and she's read a poem, The Seeker, after Tarkovsky's A Stalker, from the Incognito Body on Redhead Press. I love this poem. I love Tarkovsky. You have these incredible references to the film. There's a line in here, Rain Curtains, elsewhere a phone rings, you pick up the receiver. So in The Stalker, there's that strange, almost humorous experience, right?
It's right out of the film.
Yeah, where, you know, they're in this room and then the phone rings. But some of our viewers may or may not know Tarkovsky, but he is just this, he is the poet of cinema, right?
He is.
And this expresses an amazing entrance into this bleak world of pain, and then your daughter's interaction with you and how she's trying to reach you, and I don't know, it's surreal.
It really is surreal. When you had asked me to consider reading this, I hadn't read this poem in a long time, and I had forgotten how surreal it was. The film itself has many unexplained oddities in it, But it's basically a quest. Mm-hmm. It's basically the stalker is a guide.
Right. It's a very simple premise, but what they do with it, you know, they're trying to find, what is it, their dream
the answer to,
place.
They're trying to face their fears.
Yes.
That which they're most afraid of. And it entails going into dream, also nightmare, and into real ruins.
Right.
The ruins are allegorized.
Which, of course, corresponds to what was going on in Chernobyl at that time.
Yes.
And oddly how several of them died of cancer also at that time. Anyway, these all have resonances in this poem and in the idea of illness and how do we recover from that.
The daughter is ill, but she is telekinetic. She has telekinetic powers. And that's part of this fable. So it is a persona poem.
Okay.
That I inhabit as the seeker, not the stalker. That's a little weird in English, but as the seeker.
Yes.
And rereading this reminded me of that final scene in the movie. I don't know if you remember it, Lois, but the stalker's daughter is on his shoulders, and she's very disabled, and she makes the pitcher of water move along the table. That's where that comes from. But I embody that. I inhabit it.
And so beautifully that I actually didn't realize it was a persona poem. We're going to be wrapping up the show now, and I would love it if you could share a final poem with us.
Okay. This is narrated from the autobiographical eye. Clearly in fall, elegy for my mother. Stones are not stars, she thinks. What will I know? Autumn glasses over. To hands that hold her back, at last she cries, no more love, and casts them off. Now can she tousle free of treetops at the forest's edge, where leaves may vary, but the mountains not so much green, orange, and gold as humble. That clarity.
Beautiful. That clarity. And you are a poet of clarity. And also mystery, and deep, deep resonance with me. I urge our readers to pick up Cynthia Hoag's books, Revenants, and also The Incognito Body, and she has many other works. You can just Google her name. I'm Lois B. Jones, and my guest has been Cynthia Hoag. Look for the Poets Cafe fan page on Facebook. You've been listening to Poets Cafe on KPFK, Pacifica Radio, for all of Southern California and beyond.